Hey, welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Drexel.
And I'm Devin. And today on the pod, we are going to talk about the school walkouts on Friday. Students walked out to protest gun violence. It was the anniversary of the Columbine shooting in 1999. And then we're going to talk about the DNC lawsuit against pretty much everyone. They were just like, hey, fuck you. I'm suing everyone.
Everyone except Bernie.
Everyone except Bernie, which, you know, maybe they should have.
Yeah.
So you'll have to excuse me if I sound like a sick mess because I'm a sick mess today.
She blamed New York, guys.
I did.
I came in, she said, I'm sick. And she said, for obvious reasons. And in my head, I went, what are the obvious reasons? And the only thing I could think of in my head was, she really means New York. But then she said it out loud. And I was like, she really blamed the city of New York, a city that I love.
Hey, I love New York. That doesn't mean that it didn't get me
sick. Leave New York City alone. That is the home of Hillary Rodham Clinton.
That is true. That is true. Yeah, so I'm sorry if I sound like a sick mess. I am. So, Drexel, how was your weekend?
You know, I was not a sick mess, thank goodness, because, you know, I'm constantly sick. Really easy weekend, nothing. We went hiking on Earth Day, took Lexi out.
Oh, that's lovely.
Yep, she barely made it. You know, Lexi's like six, my dog, and she barely made it through that. But other than that, it was low key.
What about you
other than being sick?
Well, even though I'm sick, I still went to Dapper Day at Disneyland.
I saw that.
Yeah, which is where you get all dressed up and fancy and you do your hair.
Hank out dappered you guys.
He definitely did. We put him in a button-down shirt, a bow tie, and suspenders. And honestly, getting this kid to wear anything remotely like that for actual holidays or anything is like a knockdown, drag out fight. But all I had to do was say Disneyland, and he was like, whatever. Put whatever you want on me.
That's basically what you have to do to me.
Right.
Tim's like, what do you want to do? Disneyland? Great.
Great.
That'll change my mood instantly.
So it was a really good time.
Is it busy on Dapper? I've never been.
Yeah, it was really busy. I mean,
like, do you ride any rides?
Yeah, we did. You know, we'd get the fast passes, and it's hard with a kid anyway. I mean, you don't ride the good rides, but, you know.
Yeah, not taking Hank on Guardians of the Galaxy.
No.
Nah,
no.
Not yet.
Not yet.
All right, Devin, let's get into some listener feedback from last week.
Yes. So Shannon tweeted, quote, glad to hear discussion of furloughed school days on Hellbent. One aspect Devin and Drexel didn't touch on. For many children, school is the only place where they're safe, sheltered, and fed. Many only get hot meals at school. Missing a day every week is harmful. And I thought that was a really great point, you know, especially when we talk about educational policy, especially educational policy in low-income areas. A lot of people forget that school acts almost as a social services safety net in addition to educating, which, I mean, you can make the argument that it shouldn't, that there should be other safety nets in place, but...
Yeah, I was last week. I was volunteering for Bag Hunger at the Los Angeles Food Bank.
Yeah,
and one thing that I did not know was that the Los Angeles Food Bank continues, in addition to giving kids food who are in school.
Right.
When it's the break, the summer break, or the, you know, spring break, or whatever, they continue to give those meals to those kids on the food programs in the schools, which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a really good point and something that I think should be talked about more in tandem with education policy in general, because a lot of these kids have two, even three meals at school, especially if they're on a food program there.
I would be interested in knowing that in addition to these teacher walkouts and in addition to like teacher funding, if they didn't include that narrative in what they want,
right?
I think that would be helpful to them.
Yeah,
because to a parent or to a voter, particularly a conservative voter, to say, "Oh, teachers want more money," is not something that a lot of conservative representatives or some voters don't want to hear,
right?
Because they just feel like, well, why?
We all want more money.
Why do you deserve more money?
Right.
God, you do nothing for my kids.
I wish you could see Drexel's face, just sidebar.
But in addition to that, teachers can say, look, we not only have to babysit your kids, teach your kids, but also feed your kids.
Right.
And right now, we don't even have the funding to make sure that your kid is properly fed,
right,
let alone the textbooks.
Right, right.
And because if they're not getting that same nutrition, if they're not getting the nutrition at home and they're getting it at school, we don't even have the funding to do that.
Right, right.
Which has an effect on what's happening at home.
Right.
Because then your kid is going to be hungry by the time they get home,
right,
thus costing you more money.
Right. Yeah, it's a very complicated issue that is difficult to talk about, I guess. I don't think it should be. I don't think this is particularly complicated in terms of we want to do what's best for our children, like feeding them and teaching them and giving them safe space. I feel like that's not that complicated.
Right.
But it is in reality complicated.
It is. And I know we're going to talk about messaging in a little bit, but that goes to the messaging part of it. And it goes to a conversation that we had about race last week or 2 weeks ago, maybe last week, which talked about how to take a full, like a message and encompass everything.
Right. Right.
And do that successfully.
And then I also got a lot of positive feedback to the interview I did last week with Natalie, who founded Better Postpartum. Maternal mortality is not really in the news. It's not usually like a, you know, especially in this day and age, there's so much going on that, you know, you don't see about it, but it really does permeate our culture. And it is also something that disproportionately affects women of color and women in low income areas, which is probably why it doesn't get more news coverage. And it also speaks to this broader issue of ignoring female pain in general. A lot of women go see their doctor and are dismissed and, you know, not listened to. And I think that it really spoke to a lot of people because it's like, yeah, this is an issue. And even if you don't have children, even if you don't want children, there's that kernel of understanding healthcare for women needs to be reformed in and of itself.
Yeah. Grey's Anatomy actually touched on this in this last half of this current season. With Dr. Robbins and Alex Karev and April Kepner, which I thought was really interesting, something they had not touched on, as far as I know, this in depth. And so I think they're going to continue that part of the conversation as they end this season and we lose a few characters.
All right, Drexel, let's jump into our first news block. We're going to talk about the school walkouts that happened all across the country on Friday. Friday was the 19-year anniversary of the Columbine shooting. And so a couple of high schoolers organized over 2,500 walkouts. And I feel like it's not getting a ton of news coverage.
I understand that. Yep, definitely did not, because I totally had no clue.
Right.
Particularly because just the week before or 2 weeks before, we had had a similar
right
thing. So I don't know that the news was that the oversaturation of that, like we could talk about Russia, you know what I mean? Like
yeah.
So there's certain things that the news would rather
talk about.
Be talking about than another school walkout. It will have an effect on policy silently. And that's not something that, that I'm sure a lot of these news organizations wanted to jump into, especially on a Friday, and that's always news dump day. But Friday's protest, billed as the National School Walkout, was in New York City, organized by Arielle Geismer, because, you know, women leading the pack.
Yep.
She's only 16, a junior at Beacon High School, who said that students from about 35 schools from the city and New Jersey and Connecticut participated. More than 2,600 schools in every state joined in nationwide, according to the walkout's website. On Friday afternoon, Ariel stood beside the park's arched monument to George Washington, addressed the crowd. "We have been practicing school lockdown since kindergarten," she shouted. "If we are old enough to be affected by gun violence, then you're damn well sure we're old enough to have an opinion about it." course, 1999 was probably the year that a lot of them were born.
Right. Yeah. She was actually born, I think, in 2002.
Locations for the demonstrations nationally range from a park in Chicago to the State House in Texas. It was the third nationally coordinated student protest in the months since the Parkland shooting.
So I think that it's an important thing you kind of touched on earlier, where sort of fatigue of this story already, which is frustrating because that always happens with gun violence stories, is we get really into them and we do all of this stuff. And especially this time, and these kids standing up, and then it's kind of like, well, this was like the third one. Like, fuck it. Well, I'm done.
I think it's the large protest thing that's the fatigue, not the conversation.
Okay.
Because I think a lot of these kids and people associated with them are continuing to do the work on the ground that they need to, as long as that's what they're doing.
Right.
The national narrative, again, we'll talk about messaging from the Democrats in a little bit, can happen from the elected officials' standpoint.
Right.
But let locally, especially you listeners out there, do the work to call those people, especially if you're in red states that have lax gun laws.
Right.
So I don't know that a third, one protest, great. Two protests, great. The third one, the time I think could be better spent, going to the capital of each state, not necessarily just walking in a park.
Right.
Like, have those conversations one-on-one. You know, we saw those Parkland kids go to the Florida State House. You know, we saw kids in Washington, D.C. go to the Capitol and meet with legislatures. Like, that should be their focus. That should be their goal,
but
those one-on-one conversations.
But so the Parkland survivors have a pretty high profile and can get those meetings.
Anybody can get, to be honest, you can go to Washington, D.C. and walk into your representative's office. Not necessarily get a meeting with them,
right?
But you certainly can walk in, and if they're available,
right,
they certainly will come out and have a conversation with you.
Right.
So don't think that because you don't have a high profile like David and Cameron and
Emma Gonzalez,
and Emma, that you won't be able to have the same voice that they do. They just so happen to have a blue check mark that allows them a bigger platform,
right?
But you still have that opportunity.
Well, what do you think of the day that they chose, though? So a lot of people were saying that they chose this day, the anniversary of the Columbine shooting, because that sort of was the first major school shooting that in recent history that was in the news, and that they were using that to draw attention to the fact that in the 19 years since, nothing has really changed. Do you think that was effective or still kind of a waste of time?
I don't want to say that they're, what they put together was a waste of time. I just think that it could have been, I just think that their energy could have been better suited putting, like, tie that school walkout. Don't just go to the Washington, don't just go to Washington Square Park. Don't just go to go to City Hall. In New York City, it's a little bit different because it's a bunch of Democrats there. But right. Still, go to City Hall, have right. that conversation with them, because New York Democrats are some of the loudest Democrats. And then put the pressure on, some of those Democrats in New York, Chuck Schumer, and just say, hey, come to City Hall with us.
Right.
And stand there with us. So those are the types of things that they can do. I think with Columbine, yeah, I think that they attempted to tie themselves to something that they thought America would like to hear about.
Right.
And that just didn't happen, especially on a Friday where most of everybody was about to go into the weekend. And that was, and Barbara Bush's funeral was happening and Coachella was happening. And so there was a lot going on
right.
where the news cycle was just sucked up with a lot of other stuff. So yeah, if they had chosen a different day of the week, like a Wednesday, and then they said, Friday's the 19 years later,
right.
they might have been able to get into part of that news cycle.
Interesting.
So they got to start thinking. They certainly need, the Parkland students definitely have a PR firm behind them. I think that any time that national campaigns like this happen, you need a good PR person to say, you might want to rethink. Just because you think of the day works, it might not work.
Right. But then we're talking about 16-year-olds who are doing this grassroots organizing.
And great for them. That's what I'm saying is,
right.
is that to your question about was that a good tie-in? Yeah, absolutely. But then somebody's got to say, here's your tie-in. How does it work?
Right.
And is it going to be effective? And I think a lot of these kids, like, look, yeah, they're 16, but they're a lot smarter than we were at 16.
100%.
So I don't know that they don't understand that piece because they know social media, but they have right. the access to social media that we didn't. They can get the information that they want.
Right.
Yeah, they're 16. Yeah, they have they need a little bit more training to do certain things, but I don't know that. Like I said, I don't want to say that what they did was ineffective. I just want to say that I think that what they can take from this experience on Friday is channel that energy and get that same amount of people to go
register to vote,
talk to their reps, put the pressure on their parents, have those conversations with their other students in their school,
right.
their teachers, and continue to have those conversations.
Yeah.
And their school board.
And their school board.
Actually, that's really where they should be going.
Yeah. Go march on their school board.
For sure.
Yeah. And I also thought it was really interesting. Washington Post pointed out that in contrast to the other school walkouts and the other protests where they would either create a safe space for students to do so, or basically said, you know, you can do this and there won't be any ramifications. They're now saying that the administrators were less inclined to accommodate the students. And a lot said this, if you walk out, this will be an unexcused absence and you'll be subject to regular sort of disciplinary action for doing so, which I think is an interesting shift. I mean, it was kind of, I think it goes back to what we were talking about though, where the first couple was like, yeah, let's do this. Yay, 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 yay. And then we get here and it's like, we still want to have this conversation. And maybe this isn't the most effective way to message it, but they're doing it. And school administrators were like, all right, calm down.
I don't know that school. I'm not a school administrator.
Right.
But I would assume that their approach is, this is the end of the school year, and we've now given you a couple of opportunities to participate in what we believe you should be participating in. And we really need you to be in school at this point. Mm. And yes, we will continue to give you opportunity within the school. So if the approach is school administrators are saying, hey, look, we want to create spaces within the school that you can continue to have these conversations with your teachers, with your administrators, with the school board. And we will do that once a month. If they continue to do that, and say, but we do need you to be in school. We can't have you walking out every month. Then that's probably what they're saying, because they're like, okay, we gave you two.
I mean, it's interesting. And I definitely see that side of the argument. I just think that the shift in rhetoric around this, I guess maybe I'm hypersensitive to the fact that I don't want this conversation to go away. And I don't want these students to be discouraged after this initial ball of energy, you know, that I don't want to see it drain and then have the students, I'm not give up. That's not the right word. But
I think that what's going to be, we're going to see a significant drop off over the summer because the kids won't be together.
Right.
So that's going to be something that they're going to have to try to figure out how. I know a lot of the Parkland students are seniors, so they've, you know, they're in between. I know David's taking a year off of school to continue working for the midterm. So I think that that's where we're going to see the drop off. And like I said, it's the end of the year. And so that's where I think is going to be the challenge for a lot of these students. But, you know, we just had a shooting in Tennessee last week. So not only are we continue to have those conversations, because this gun conversation will never stop, because every month we will continue to have a shooting somewhere inside of schools, outside of schools. This was in a Waffle House. And y'all know, listen, I'm from the South. I love me a Waffle House. But, you know, and this kid went to the White House, not into the White House, but went to the White House, was like corralled by Secret Service. His firearms were taken away from him, given to his dad because he was like a minor, basically. And his dad gave them back to him.
Right. Yeah.
No, sir. I don't work like that. They just caught him. I just got the notification that they got that. But, you know, so that part of the conversation is not going to go away.
Right. Well, I also wanted to bring up, Politico had a great article about how students of color, Black students, are being left out of this debate. And I know that, you know, like David Hogg had taken steps to point out that fact. But the fact of the matter is that the sort of quote unquote face of this movement right now is a bunch of white kids. And then Emma Gonzalez is the only student of color. She identifies as Cuban. And they spoke to Janetta Elzey, who is a civil rights activist. And she was key in the 2014 Ferguson protests. And she has kind of just made these observations about how the media is treating the Parkland students differently from the way they treated Black activists, and how that dichotomy is really making it difficult to have this intersectional conversation about solutions to the gun violence problem.
I think that the media is only as good as shutting them out as the organizers, if that makes sense.
What do you mean?
Meaning, if David and the rest of them really wanted their Black students to be a part of that conversation, they would have... I mean, it's 2018. You can find a couple of people to hang out with you.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, right. So it's not like they couldn't. If you go on, if you're asked to do a media interview, David and Emma and Cameron and those kids had ample opportunity to say, we actually won't come on this program without another couple of people of color on right. here. And we really need them to be a part of that.
Right. So paying lip service, I think David Hogg has said something, right. but paying lip service and then actually doing something about it are two different things.
It's two different things. So that's why I said the media is only going to ask the leadership what they want to do and if they can come on. It is up to people who go out there to say, yeah, we're going to come on, but we won't do it without X, Y, and Z concessions.
Right.
Because you need our story. You need us. We need you. So let's work together on it.
Right.
And so I think that it's going to be on people who organize these continue to organize these things to say, yeah, here's let's shift this part of our message to include those students as well.
Yeah. Gun violence in America, you know, especially recently, we've been talking about school shootings and mass shootings. But gun violence in America isn't just about that. There are many facets to it. And Janetta Elzey was protesting police violence, which is a different type of gun violence, though it all falls under the same umbrella. And, you know, she pointed out that while the Parkland kids were lauded, she was labeled as a threat actor. And she was actually, the FBI attempted to contact her and her family. And it was a tactic that she thinks was meant to intimidate her, which I'm sure it was. And so the sort of, again, like you said, the way the media is treating the two, you know, these two issues is so different. And I understand what you're saying about it being up to these kids to say, hey, we're going to bring X, Y, and Z on.
Well, the adults and then the adults, and the adults in the room. I'm saying both of them.
Right.
It is the media's job to include, but it's also the other side's job to include.
Right.
And if the media's not doing it, then somebody has to, and it's got to be the people who are organizing.
Yeah, it's difficult because it's very frustrating because it seems so obvious when you put these two events side by side. These Parkland students who are catching their fair share of shit, but they're not being labeled as threat actors and terrorists in the same way. And the systemic issues on how we view race and gun violence are undeniably at play here. And actually, Tiffany Dina Loftin, who's the national director of the NAACP Youth and College Division, said, quote, it's intentional for that narrative, especially when we're talking about politics, to tap into anti-Blackness. And when we have conversations around gun violence, public health, safety, education, this country's agenda, because it's led mostly by white men who are in political office and Congress. It is in the interest of their reputation to always exclude and not prioritize young people of color, LGBT communities, and those in low income areas. So what we have to do is make sure that when we show up, we continue to push and make known what our agenda items are and what issues of gun violence look like in our communities specifically, so we can have a holistic, intersectional conversation around solutions.
I'd like to see every time we introduce a new issue to the American public or continue to bring up an issue, that those on TV, especially if you have a partner, like if you go on and it's a dual interview or whatever, or you're doing a speech or a town hall or a rally or whatever, that you're bringing somebody of color up with you.
Right.
Like, I'd like to see that be the push.
Right.
Because then you're getting it from all sides.
Right.
And I was talking to my brother yesterday who, we were talking about Starbucks, the Starbucks situation. And he said, I really hope that there is at least one black person in every meeting when Starbucks does their training across the country. He said, because it was just true. If it's A, not led by a person of color,
right,
and B, there's not a person of color in the room, then you just got a bunch. You got a bunch of white folks talking to white folks, and that's not going to help anybody.
Right.
So, yes. Yeah, so that's why I think that we have to continue to, as we shape messages, make sure that the message includes people of color, not just in the message, but to help push the message.
Right. You know, when you talk about taking in intersectional conversations about solutions, you also have to think about the solutions that have already been proposed in response to something like the Parkland shooting, which is increased police presence in schools. But if police violence is an issue in communities of color and there are students of color in these schools, then increased police presence isn't necessarily safer for these students.
True.
And so arming teachers who have, you know, have their own biases, all these other things. Like, we're calling for solutions to one problem that exacerbate another problem.
And I think that in those, like, we're all, you know, folks that listen to this, and us, obviously, we skew on the more liberal side of things.
No.
Yeah, don't say. But I also think that between this podcast and a couple of the others, there's very few podcasts that have a person of color as a part of the conversation.
Right.
You know, as much as I mean, I listen to Pod Saves America both Tuesdays now and Friday, but they don't have a person of color on. They do bring DeRay on. They do bring a couple other people on. But I think having that, just maybe one person of color in there, listen, I think that would probably help them out,
right,
with a lot of people, because then somebody can say, wait, well, I don't know about what you're saying right now.
Right.
I think that we in 2018, it is imperative to have a person of color, not only in on your staff, not only as a part of what you, especially in politics, of what you're pushing, in your hiring practices, in your classrooms, as a part of your friend circle. If you don't have a person of color in your, this is for listeners. If you don't have a person of color in your friend circle, you might want to find one.
Well, and I think kind of to that point, there's another great quote from Elsie, the activist that we talked about earlier. She said, quote, if the more privileged are at the front, what happens to the more marginalized students or communities? Erasure. Just good old erasure.
Truth.
All right, Drexel, I want to talk about the DNC.
My favorite. Actually, I just tweeted out a thing where somebody said, it's the job of the DNC. The job of the DNC is to elect Democrats, not Republicans, not independents pretending to be Democrats, not green Democrats. If you aren't a Democrat, it isn't the party's job to help you win. So let's talk about the party.
Let's talk about the party. So the DNC has filed a lawsuit, as I said at the top of the show, against what feels like every single person. I mean, not really. I'm obviously being facetious, but they filed this lawsuit against Russia as a whole, the GRU, Julian Assange, WikiLeaks, Donald Trump Jr., and like a whole host of other people. So what is going on here?
The DNC lawsuit, like you said, talks about the infiltrated DNC network as far back as July 27th, 2015. That was a long time ago.
It was a long time ago.
Nearly a year before the leaks that we all saw happened. Tom Perez last week during an interview in ABC News said, "I don't know when Director Mueller's investigation is going to end, so we need to file now to protect our rights. We've got elections coming up this November. It's hard to win elections when you have interference in elections. They've done it with impunity, and I'm concerned that it's going to happen again. So that's why we did it now." But Perez, who had no role at the DNC during the 2016 campaign, told Chuck Todd this weekend that he was confident that we will get a jury trial and that the lawsuit was necessary to protect both the committee and the U.S. elections. He also added that he had not consulted Hillary Clinton to ask her permission before filing the complaint. "We had people on our team who got death threats. When you do that to people on my team, yeah, I'm going to push back."
It's interesting. When I heard that they had filed this lawsuit, I was kind of like, can you even do that? Is that even a thing? Can the DNC collectively file a lawsuit? Obviously you can, but I didn't really know the larger context until I believe it was on the podcast Slow Burn, which is Slate's podcast, where they talked about the last time the DNC filed a lawsuit, which was back in the early 70s in response to the Watergate break-ins. And before people even thought Nixon was in the mix of the Watergate break-ins, they said, no, this goes all the way to the top and we're suing for monetary damages because this is bullshit. This is political espionage and we're not here for it. So I feel like that's the strategy they're taking again.
Right. And I think because the entire server infiltration thing was really costly to the DNC in general.
It was.
The suit details the necessary fixes that the DNC had to do. They had to decommission more than 140 servers, remove and install all their software, including the operating systems for more than 180 computers. They had to rebuild at least 11 servers. And between repairing and replacing equipment and hiring experts to manage the fallout, the bill came out to over $1 million, which we know as members of the party that the DNC barely had it to begin with.
Right, exactly. And these were all necessary. And you know, you can make arguments about having better security in the first place, but we're past that at this point.
Right.
Like, this is what happened. This is the reality of it. And I also think what's really interesting about this strategy in particular is that when you file lawsuits, things become public record.
On both sides.
On both sides. Correct. Right. And so a big part of this was they got to publish a more detailed timeline of what happened, who did it, and when. And the beginning part of the timeline was always kind of murky, you know, we had a pretty solid timeline that was reported out from about July 2016. But they got to establish a lead-up timeline, basically, in this lawsuit. And, you know, what's also interesting is many months ago, I spoke to a fellow Hellion named Olivia, who's a lawyer. And I asked her, I was like, what do you think is going to bring, if anything, is going to bring this Trump presidency down, this whole scandal to light? And she said computer crimes, because computer crimes are pretty easy to trace. So Nick Ackerman, who is a partner at the New York office of Dorsey and Whitney Law Firm, said, quote, "There is no way it's going to be dismissed, at least not on the computer fraud part of the case, which is really the heart of it. The Democrats have every right to bring this suit as they are aggrieved. My question is, what took them so long?" But I think that's a really interesting point, is that this was at its heart a computer crime, which is a crime, and it's a pretty provable crime. You know, they're not asking for like this sort of theoretical, intangible thing. They're saying our computers were hacked. It's a crime. We're suing. And if this goes forward, Democrats are going to have a chance to ask for internal documents and get depositions from the Trump campaign to help them learn how they, how, if they were connected to the Russian interference. And I think that that's why they filed this lawsuit. Yes, $1 million is a lot of money that we didn't have, but I think that this is a really great way to demand that the Trump campaign sort of put the burden of proof on them and say, you need to prove that you weren't part of this.
Yeah, I think that there are some, obviously I support Chairman Perez and Keith Ellison and the rest of the DNC on this tactic of making sure that we're putting the pressure on the Trump administration the way that it should be. I also hope that the DNC is also pushing Congress to pass laws that would, which they've already done in terms of sanctions that the Trump administration has not
implemented
yet. However, the Congress can also implement laws to protect elections.
Like the elections themselves.
The elections themselves, and they need to do that in tandem with secretaries of states across the country. And unless the DNC is planning on doing that, so for example, if the DNC rolled out a strategy with Democratic secretaries of states across the country and said, here's what we are doing to protect our elections, that should be the narrative.
So this goes back to a messaging issue and how this yes. lawsuit is part of a larger message. So I know that you're a delegate for California and the DNC, and you have lots of thoughts about messaging. So can you kind of connect the two for us? Like, how can they use this lawsuit to better create a message?
Like I said, I think that it has, the strategy can't just be, let's talk about the lawsuit. It has to be one of the things that the problem that we've always known with the Democrats is that there is a top line message without any underlying details. If you're going to say, we're going to file this lawsuit without any, and here's our plan, we know that Hillary Clinton had a similar messaging problem, not only from what we perceive from the outside, we also saw it during the leaks of the DNC emails that the Clinton campaign was having a messaging problem and that they were trying to figure out how to fix it. So if Democrats going forward, especially into the midterms, are going to start to talk about Russia, American voters don't want to just hear about Russia anymore. They want to hear about Russia in tandem with what you're going to do about it. We know that the Trump administration is not going to do anything about Russia. Donald Trump himself, considering he has not even implemented the sanctions that Congress has laid out, and Congress, Republican Congress people have not even put the pressure on him to remind him that he needs to do that. That has to come from the Speaker of the House, and that needs to come from Mitch McConnell. So Democrats have to take this lawsuit and say, here's what we're going to do. Here's our plan. But instead of just going after the Trump administration, because then Donald Trump could come out, as he has over the past weekend, and say the obstructionist Democrats are in the DNC, they're putting this out. And then, of course, Republicans are going to try to change the narrative to, oh, great, you know, in their Scooby-Doo villain ways to say, oh, we can't wait to get our hands on the DNC servers that they never turned over to the FBI. Whereas Tom Perez can say, look, let me tell you, there's nothing in these servers that nobody's seen. B, here's what we plan on doing about that. That the narrative, I think, should be, our job is to protect democracy and the American voter, and here's how we plan on doing it.
Well, what is interesting is that the complaint literally alleges that top Trump campaign officials conspired with the Russian government. Should that be part of the messaging here? Not just, here's what we're going to do about it, but like, we believe that the Russian government and its military spy framework set out to hurt the Democratic presidential nominee, and that the Trump campaign was part of it.
I think you can do that as a part of saying, here's what we're doing and here's why we're doing it. I think coming out with that first could be an issue, because then it just looks like you're going after the Trump administration. Instead of saying, we're protecting democracy, and here's why we feel like we have to do that. Here is why we are doing that. As outside of everything that you've heard, here is what we believe from from what we know, to be the reason as to why we need to lock down elections across the country. And if Republican secretaries of state want to follow, want to work with us on that, then they are welcome to do that. But right now, we're going to protect California. We're going to protect New York. We're going to protect Washington. We're going to protect some of the other blue states, Massachusetts, some of the other blue states across the country, because that is what we believe we're going to do. And if Republicans don't want to protect your vote, then they don't deserve your vote. And that needs to be the message.
Not this anti-Trump.
Not this anti-Trump thing. Because again, Democratic voters who either they didn't come out to vote last year or whatever would say, the Democrats have a plan. Democrats have a plan on, this is the start of Democrats having a plan on infrastructure. What is your infrastructure? This is the Democrats laying their 2018 midterm strategy out to talk about the issues in a way of saying, here is the alternative to this problem.
That also sounds a lot like, when they go low, we go high, which is lovely, but also not how the Republicans are playing this game.
Right.
Should we get on their level?
I think you can do both at the same time. You just can't do one or the other.
I see.
Right now, it looks like Democrats are just doing
one
and not coming back and saying, here's what we plan on doing about it.
I see.
It's like, oh, Republicans want to vote against healthcare.
Give me more information.
But give me more information and talk about the fix that you plan on doing.
Yeah.
Oh, Republicans don't want to talk about infrastructure. Okay. The Trump administration touted at least 2 or 3 weeks of infrastructure week that never happened.
Right.
Democrats could have said, we're going to do our own infrastructure week. This is going to be our message. We're going to do an infrastructure month. We're going to come out there and every week you're going to hear a new plan about what we plan on doing from 2018 and beyond. And here's what we're going to do. We plan on talking about education. We're going to talk about our education plan every month, education week. Take the White House's narrative that they're not doing because they don't have a narrative and change that into
here's what you plan on doing.
Because the criticism that not only Hillary Clinton got, but other Democrats across the country got was, we don't have a message and we don't know what you stand for. If Democrats got out there and started to say, here's the plan, that we look at the DNC, here's the thing about it is, it can't come from the DNC. The DNC is a fundraising mechanism. This has to be the strategy of the DCCC and Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, the DSCC, the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, and all those together to say, here is our strategy across the board. It cannot be just against Donald Trump. I know the guys on Pod Save America talk about it all the time. I think that we need to remind voters that. I think that when you have your conversations, when you go to your town halls and you continue to have those conversations, you don't need to ask the question about Russia anymore and what you're doing about Russia and what your vote, because you already know what their vote's going to be. You need to ask them about how Democrats' messaging is going to be better for the 2018 election, because that's what voters actually want to hear about.
Yeah. Oh, I think that's great. I love hearing your thoughts on messaging, because I think that's one thing that we can really learn from the Republican Party. Like,
they know how to message.
They know how to message.
It might be, they know
we
how
might
to message,
hate it.
They know how to message negatively,
which is a way to do
great,
it.
Great. But I don't know why it's like, I always complain, because I'm like, a majority of communications professionals are Democrats. How is it that the top communications people across the country have not said, we got to help the Democrats out somehow? Shit, because they're fucking up and they don't have a message that, you know, it's like Tom Steyer out there with these ads. I'm like, dude, you could put that money into a really good communications team for the DNC. How about you do that? I don't want to see another impeach Trump fucking ad on TV interrupting my mad out time because you want to spend $1 million an ad on that when you could be spending that $1 million on somebody helping a message out. How about you help get the Democrats' message out? How about you do that? All right, Devin, let's get into some gratitude check.
Yes. So this week, I am very grateful for, this is so cheesy, but for the opportunities that have presented themselves because of this pod, because of the community, because of what we're doing here. As I'm sure none of you have heard, because I haven't talked about it at all, I was in Connecticut and New York, and I was on Good Morning Connecticut. And it was just such an amazing experience to see my dreams come true. Again, I know that sounds so silly, but I have always wanted to be a person, a knowledgeable person, someone who matters in the community, someone who's affecting change, someone who's getting that message out. And I really didn't know how to go about it at all. Like when I was younger, when I was in college, in college, I had no idea what I wanted to do. After college, I had no idea what I wanted to do. And I bounced around for a while. And so basically seeing my dreams come true in real time, and it has just been absolutely mind-blowing. I was telling Drexel before we got started, my flight to New Jersey was 7 hours delayed. So I missed all of the trains from New Jersey to Connecticut.
Oh, that's why you're sick, because you went into New Jersey. Makes a whole lot of sense now.
Great state of New Jersey. And so I had to move my train to the 1:30 a.m. train so I would get to Connecticut in time for the show. But that was delayed by 2 hours. So I spent 2 hours in Penn Station in New Jersey just chilling. So I got on the 3:30 train, got into New Haven around 6 a.m., went to a Starbucks bathroom, changed, put on makeup, and went to the studio and did a live TV segment after 24 hours of travel with almost no sleep. And I was so happy.
It looked great.
Thank you.
It looked great. It sounded great. It looked like a lot of fun. And mm-hmm. I know I posted it in the group.
Yep.
So if you are a listener and you're not a part of the group, you should become one.
Yep.
And Dick wants that's to be where gone. You get all the good information.
All the goodies. Welcome, new listeners.
Good afternoon.
Noon, Connecticut. Yeah.
I you know what I didn't ask you about?
Huh?
Was Harry Potter.
And I saw,
I know you have to keep the secrets.
I will keep the secrets. Hashtag keep the secrets.
Keep the secrets.
So I saw Harry Potter and the Cursed Child parts 1 and 2 while I was in New York. It was an anniversary gift from my husband. And he got me like the super fancy special tickets that you get access to the lounge and your own private bathroom. Oh. And I saw both parts in one day. It was a 6-hour endeavor. And it was probably the best 6 hours of my life. It was amazing.
What was your favorite part?
Okay, so...
Without revealing.
So there's a scene where there's this bookcase that comes alive and it like sucks people in and like things are flying out of it. And I had no idea how they were going to do it. And it looked like magic.
If you haven't read the book, Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, it's actually the rehearsal script. So the revisions... So what you actually read in the book is not actually... There have been revisions
right.
since heading to West End and then, of course, headed to Broadway. But it's good.
It's so good.
I mean, it's not like Harry Potter good, but it's like good.
And honestly, like reading it is one thing, but then seeing it, you're like, oh, I get it. And honestly, I have to say, because being there in person and seeing it, it felt like magic. They were doing some like tricks and some, you know, stage stuff that looked and felt like magic.
Because magic is everywhere.
Is everywhere. And it just...
I almost said magic is might, but I am not a...
No.
A Professor Umbridge.
Right. Style. But yeah, so it was just amazing to get to do that, to get to see Harry Potter, and just basically like living my goddamn dreams.
That is amazing. They opened last night and rave reviews, and J.K. Rowling was there and it looked a lot of fun.
It was amazing.
I'm excited to see it in September.
Yes. So Drexel, what are you grateful for?
One thing I didn't mention, and I can't remember if I told you, something happened a couple of weeks ago at my apartment where an abandoned building next to my apartment had caught on fire.
What?
And then there was like a fireball that went into the into our complex,
what?
But into the building that's next to mine.
Oh my God.
And ended up like wiping out 4 apartments on that side. It was like backdraft in that.
Whoa. Bitch.
Yeah, it was nuts. And it was like 1 o'clock in the morning and I heard Well, what I thought was the tamale lady, because we have a tamale lady that comes around every morning. So I didn't know what time it was. And she's like, tamales. And like, it's great, which I haven't tried because I know that those tamales are bomb.
Yeah.
And so all I heard was fire. So I didn't know. I thought it was the tamale lady. And so Tim was like, oh, we got to get up. There's a fire. I was like, no, there's not. He's like, you see the smoke? I was like, no, there's not. And sure enough, so like I grab Lexi, I grab my phone, and that's about it. Tim's still inside. He's like, you know, closing shit up and finding stuff. I was like, Tim, what are you doing? I'm like outside already. I'm like, like you just told me that you gotta go.
Like, let's go.
You're in the house trying to find shit. Yeah, like,
let's move.
Let's go. Everything can be replaced. So we get outside, and it's just, I mean, and I tell you, it looked like backdraft.
Right.
And all this to say, the 38 fire trucks that wiped that blaze out in half an hour,
yeah,
was amazing.
Yeah.
And so kudos to LAFD like 80 and 86, like those guys in the valley, because that was it was nuts.
That's really scary.
It was both scary and both like intriguing,
yeah, because
it's shit that you see on TV,
right
and you're like, I've never seen this before,
right?
And it was a bunch of ash, just, you know, like I said, it was 1 o'clock in the morning, so people were out,
right,
like looking from
other areas,
and it was a work night,
right?
So there was a lot going on. So you had, then news crew started coming and fire people started,
wow,
and like ambulance, so like the entire street of Lancashire was kind of shut down, wow, because they had all of these trucks down there. And like I said, in
so
half
happy
an hour.
Yeah, happy you pay your taxes, huh? Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
This is the reason why city taxes are needed and federal taxes are needed, so we could pay these firefighters, some of who are volunteer firefighters,
right,
and who risk their lives certainly to put fires out in half an hour.
That's amazing.
All right, Devin, it is our favorite time of the week, which is our dickwad of the week.
Week.
One day we're gonna actually record that.
So actually we have two dickwads.
Oh, it's dose.
It's dose, because I couldn't choose. So I did both. So this week it is Amy Chozick and Kevin Williamson. So let's start with Amy Chozick, because this is maybe not the most obvious dickwad of the week. She wrote a book about covering the Clinton campaign. And she adapted an essay for the New York Times about it. And it was almost self-reflective as a media person covering the Clinton campaign. Like it got so close to examining the inane media coverage during the 2016 election and the sort of influences and how Russia played into it. And then you get to this, quote, "Of course, these outside forces wouldn't have mattered or weighed so heavily on me, on the country, had Hillary Clinton, her campaign, and her longtime aides, the same box of broken toys who'd enabled all of her worst instincts since the 1990s, not let the election get so close in the first place. The Russians, after all, didn't hack into her calendar and delete the Wisconsin rallies."
Okay.
I mean, first of all, this is a dead horse. Shut the fuck up about it. I'm so bored of this. This is like every single, like, I don't understand why reporters, why women want to dismiss this very real Russian influence campaign, this very real issue of, like I said, inane media coverage of the 2016 campaign, and place this all squarely back on the fact that, what, Hillary didn't have enough Wisconsin rallies, and that, you know, the election got so close and it shouldn't have? Are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah, it's interesting. I saw that because I also think is this the same article that Chelsea Clinton had to chime in on?
I think so.
Where there was a part in it where she was like, that never really happened. Yeah. Had you asked me about it, I would have told you.
Right.
I think that I feel like Amy Cho, like people like Amy Chozak want somebody within the Clinton campaign and maybe Hillary Clinton herself to come out and say, yes, Russia influenced the election, and yes, there could have been parts of the campaign that we could have done differently, including Wisconsin. I feel like that's all they want to hear her say.
Right.
And like, you're like, okay.
Well, and this also narrative that just drives me bananas is that the election shouldn't have gotten that close. Like, it shouldn't have been such an uphill battle because Trump is such a fucking caricature. But you know what? Americans love a good caricature. And they obviously were responding to this dog whistle, not even dog whistle, just overt, racist, sexist. I mean, Donald Trump admitted that he sexually assaults women and people still voted for him. And I think Nate Silver tweeted, he's a 538, he said, quote, "I really do appreciate that Chozick is willing to be so self-reflective in her book, but the idea that the polls / forecast showed Clinton to be inevitable is a fairly persistent myth. Instead, the media cherry-picked and misinterpreted data in service of that narrative." So it's kind of like this full circle thing. It's like, it shouldn't have been that close. Clinton should have won because the media cherry-picked that data and kept reporting that it should have happened. And then the media kept reporting about her emails and all these other things. So it's like this like back and forth circle of hell that seems to just go on forever.
Yeah, I mean, listen, we know that the Republicans are going to spend 2018 with Hillary Clinton as a part of their messaging campaign. So it seems like Amy and articles like this are going to continue to aid in that piece of it, but it doesn't really help them because, like, she lost.
The only place that Hillary Clinton is president is on Fox News,
right? And within the Republican narrative, right. And so that's why I said that's why I think earlier in the episode when we talked about messaging, Democrats are just going to have to come out with something else.
Yeah,
like don't make Trump the boogeyman, because then Trump can make Hillary Clinton the boogeyman. You have to make their policies the boogeyman,
right? Right.
And don't feed into their, well, you had that person. So, I mean, you were going to talk about our person, so we're going to talk about your person. Right. No.
Like, stop. Just like, stop.
That's not the way to do it.
All right. So our second dickwad is Kevin Williamson. For those of you who don't know, Kevin Williamson once said that women who get abortions should be hanged, and he was hired by The Atlantic to be their, you know, conservative shock jock, basically. After these comments came out, it was like 3 days later, The Atlantic fired him. So Kevin Williamson, whose feelings are very hurt, wrote a piece for Wall Street Journal called "When the Twitter Mob Came for Me." Okay, so here's the thing. First of all, why is Wall Street Journal giving this dickwad a platform? Like, it's not edgy. And even if it was edgy, it's Wall Street Journal. Like, that's not your thing. Get over it. Second of all, he's basically saying in this piece in Wall Street Journal that his comments were taken out of context, everyone is against him, everyone is lying, and that he shouldn't have lost his job. Wah, wah, boo-hoo. I mean, that was the whole article. And I'm pretty riled up about this. I don't know if you can tell, but there are two choice quotes that I just want to talk about. He talked about this event at South by Southwest. He goes, quote, "where The Atlantic was sponsoring a panel about marginalized points of view and diversity in journalism. The panelists, all Atlantic writers and editors, argued that the cultural and economic decks are stacked against feminists and advocates of minority interests. They made this argument under the prestigious high-profile auspices of South by Southwest and their own magazine, hosted by a feminist group called The Female Quotient, which enjoys the patronage of Google, Pepsi, AT&T, NBC Universal, Facebook, blah, blah, blah. We should all be so marginalized. If you want to know who actually has the power in our society and who is actually marginalized, ask which ideas get you sponsorships from Google and Pepsi and which get you fired. Fuck you, you spoiled, sanctimonious little scourge of a human." What the fuck are you talking about? He's saying that because he got fired from The Atlantic for making disgusting comments about women, that's somehow marginalization that is tantamount to women and people of color and other marginalized groups. You gotta be fucking kidding me. Get the fuck out of here. And then, and you know, and then he goes on, he really like doubles down on being a male white dickwad. And he says, quote, whatever you think of my views on this issue, I'd suggest that they're more interesting than hearing someone repeat the same shop-worn talking points on capital punishment for the thousandth time. The editors of The Atlantic thought so, too, until the mob started doing their thinking for them. Yeah, please tell me more about intellectual diversity and how a small-minded white dude is the victim here.
Well, he's going to be great over on Breitbart.
Right?
Him and Milo, best buddies.
Fuck this guy.
Yeah, fuck that guy.
Okay, Drexel, last but not least, let's do a couple of action items. So something that our listeners can do after the show. First, I put in donate to Planned Parenthood and bonus points if you do it in Kevin Williamson's name, because since he thinks women who get abortion should be hanged, I say we show him that he's so fucking... I ran out of words there for a minute. I apologize. Also, something that we didn't get to in the show today, but I think is worth talking to. We talked a lot about the midterms coming up. So you should really get involved with a local campaign on any level. City, state, city council, Congress, anything. Because there have been a lot of stories about how Democrats are seriously in play for seats that they've never even attempted to win before. In Colorado, every single seat has a Democrat running. Every single seat. And so this is how we keep the blue wave going. And I think that getting involved is going to be so important. Not just donating money, but donating time and registering people to vote and knocking on doors. That's going to be the important part.
Colorado, I think one of the big things that we live in California, so we're trying to overturn 11 or 12 Republican seats here, and all of them are being challenged here. Again, I'm hoping that, you know, as you continue to have those conversations with your local elected officials and your federal representatives, that you're reminding them that their narrative has to be something very specific, especially on the campaign trail, because that is what is going to get them elected. Having every seat in Colorado and across the country is great, but it won't be a wave without a message. So continue to push the messaging part of it. Because right now, you know, we saw today, even some of our Democrats, that like, we don't want to lose them, but, you know, Heidi Heitkamp and Joe Manchin and Chris Donnelly, you know, those guys are voting for Mike Pompeo to be Secretary of State. And yeah, those are folks that we still need to keep the numbers that we have. And if they can't, we have to do both of protecting them in their red states, as well as having a better national message. And the only way for Democrats to do that is for you to push that message out there.
So, and then Roxane Gay also had an amazing piece in the New York Times that I just want to remind everyone about activism. We talked a lot about activism fatigue today. She said, quote, what you describe in your letter is not apathy. She's responding to someone who had written her saying that she just can't do all of this activism. She said, quote, you are human, a woman trying to balance your own needs with doing good. I would worry if you didn't care about the state of the world. I would worry if you didn't ask this question. So you don't have to do everything. Just the fact that you care and doing what you can is enough. Well, that is it for us. Thank you so much for listening. Drexel and I will be back here on Monday, and I will be here on Thursday with a new guest. So raise hell.
Bye.
Thank you.